Right, okay, we're good. So recording this lesson, which is a review of Sefer Yehoshua. Before I start, I just want to mention a couple of general things about the exam. As much as I hate talking about exams, as you've probably gathered by now, it's one of those things that we just have to do. College is, that's unfortunately what it's about. Obviously the first thing I want to mention to you is the format of the exam. I'll just go over some stuff I've already said to you, but I want to just put it all in one section and say that the format will be 5 out of 6 questions. They will, each question will have parts. So please read each question carefully. Okay, don't just do part A and then go on to the next question. There's A, usually A, B, and maybe even C. If it asks your opinion, give your opinion. Some questions will ask for more general information. If you don't remember who said it, don't worry about that. If you don't remember it was Rashi or whatever, as long as you give me the idea what exactly is being said, that is quite okay. Also, you can answer the questions in any order that they come. Okay, so don't worry about that. If you want to do number 6 before you want to do number 3, absolutely fine. Pet peeve, I suppose I would say, is for people who write all over the books. And what I mean by that is, let me get a book and I'll show you what I mean. Although now they come in blue covers, but basically the front is for putting your name and whatever. Please do not write on the inside covers. Do not write on these covers, be they blue, whatever colour that is, not quite sure what that is, grey something, because it is number 1, it's very annoying, and number 2, it makes it incredibly difficult to grade. Okay, even if, and as I said last time, even if you have one word to finish your essay and you need to go over to another page, take another book. There really are millions of these books which are sitting in some sort of warehouse here or wherever they're being kept, and there really is not a shortage of that particular item. Don't hesitate. And if you want to write not double-sided, but you want to write single-sided as well, that's quite acceptable. Obviously, I would like very much that you don't use the margin. Right? Sometimes people write right across the margin. The whole idea of the margin is to give people like me, so, you know, if I want to do sort of smiley faces or whatever, I can get a chance to put those in the margin. I can't put them in otherwise, so it's very difficult. But seriously, it really would help a lot if you just observe the basic rules of aren't using an answer book, okay? Obviously, mark your books, 1, 2, and 3, whatever. You know, usually, I don't get usually more than 3, but it may happen, but make sure it's clearly marked. I'm not really going to say much more than that because I think it's pretty obvious. I usually get this question, can I use pen or pencil? I prefer you to use pen, but please do not, and I've said this before, do not use the colour that was once used by a young lady who's probably now married with probably 3 children, who wrote in something I can only describe as bright pink. It was great for reading while I was falling asleep because it was literally luminous. I could actually read this under the covers. It was very exciting. But was it? No, I don't make this up. It's really, this is for real. But the reality is, if you are going to write with a normal pen, please write blue, black, whatever. But, you know, make it presentable. Don't have to say much more than that. I think most of you know what I mean. Okay, but no pinks, no purples. I'm looking at purple computers, but I'm hoping that will be the extent of the purple. What else should I say about the exam? Obviously, there are 2 hours. There's plenty of time. All right, if you've got extension allowance, then obviously that will be respected. If you don't finish in the 2 hours, I will take you to wherever the other proctor is sitting, usually downstairs in that room as you come into the building, or somewhere like that, and you can finish the exam. But most people tend to finish within an hour and a quarter to an hour and a half. Hi. What I would say to you is, please do not do what another young lady who is now, again, probably married with at least maybe even 4 children by now, who did decide to book a flight to Israel at 5 in the afternoon. The exam was from 1 till 3. Now, how she actually expected, without doing something out of Star Trek, you know, beaming up and beaming down, how she was expecting to get to Kennedy in about 10 minutes from here, I really do not know. It's seriously a problem. And what happened was that she came to the exam, told me this, and I hadn't known before, I would have told her to change her booking, but she didn't. And it was a problem. She finished the exam in about 20 minutes when she should have taken probably an hour and 20 minutes. And the sad story is that, you know, instead of getting an A, which she should have done, she probably ended up with a C. Just not worth it. If you're going to book flights or you're going to book traveling, make traveling arrangements, do not do so within that time frame. In other words, give yourself plenty of time to finish the exam and then go and do whatever you wish to do. So again, I tell these stories of woe, but they really are true stories. Any questions about the kind of general exam stuff before we go on to the specifics? I hope that sort of covered the main items. Okay? Yes, question? Very good question. The whole question of bringing books. On the exam it will say you can bring a book which is either Mikrot Gedolot, Hebrew only, which you can bring in, or if you want to bring in a Hebrew English, then just a basic translation. It can be Koran, it can be JPS, it can be any one of those, but not the Judaica book that I've encouraged you to get your hands on, because that's just too much information in that book. That's not a book that you should have in the exam. But if you want to bring in a Hebrew English translation, and again, don't be afraid to use the text. Okay. If there's a question about, I don't know, just basic quotations, kind of something which, Shemesh Begivon Dom, you know, if you want to talk about the famous speech of Yeshua, then quote it. Don't just sort of assume that everybody knows it. Say it out. Okay, and write it. You don't have to write the whole pasuk, you just write a little bit of it. Then it shows me that you are not only, you're not only saying it, but you're actually aware of where it comes from. And that is very important. If you want to highlight your Tanakh with, sort of a highlighter just to make different sections stand out, I have no problem with that whatsoever. I would not suggest writing in very small print all the answers on the inside cover of the Tanakh. That's not a good idea. And again, it's not really going to help you very much anyway. So that's a great question. Okay, Hebrew English or Mikrot Gedolot without the English. Any other questions on the actual exam? Please turn up on time. Somebody once came in half an hour. I think after 30 minutes, I don't know if I'm allowed to let you in. I've got to read all that whole spiel again about leaving your stuff, putting it to one side, and the whole cheating issue, which I really don't even want to talk about, because I'm just glad to say that I've never seen it as a problem, and I hope it isn't a problem. But again, give yourself plenty of time to be here, and the exam will start, hopefully, as it should do. And I think we're doing it at 1 o'clock, if I'm not mistaken. The third, get the date right. Somebody actually did one year get the date wrong. Came on the fourth and realized that it should have been the third, and really had a big problem. Massive problem, because the administration was not too impressed. Nowadays, with your smartphones, there's no excuse anymore. Plug it in, say, it'll give you a reminder. Keep bleeping till you throw the thing out of the window anyway. Obvious reason, it's not going to let you alone until you actually recognize that there's an event, as they call it. Anything otherwise? No. All right, good. Now, we're going to look at this review sheet. I do have literally another few copies, which are spares, but I have given, if you want to just take one of those. Hopefully all of you have something in front of you. If there's just two copies here, if anyone needs. And what we will do is go through the subjects, right, as we go along, and just look a bit at the handouts which I've given you. I should have them all here. At least I try to keep all of them in a file. Maybe not so successfully, but whatever, did try. Okay, now, question number one, introduction to the Sefer and the period of entry into Eretz Yisrael. Okay, now what did we say about Sefer Yehoshua, and again, please help me out here, what did we say about Sefer Yehoshua, which makes it extremely unique in terms of the books of Tanakh? Okay, we've got 24 books of the Bible, but why is Yeshua particularly special? Yeah, what's not? What did we say? Excellent. In other words, there really was meant to be not five books of Moses, but there was meant to be Shisha Chumashim, if that's the way to describe it, Shisha Sfarim. Okay? And the sixth book was meant to be the book of Yeshua, period. Why did we have all the other books then? Why did all the other books get written? The book of Shmuel and Shoftim and everything else. Was that part of the plan, or was that as a reaction to something? Right? Again, help me out here, somebody. We've got notes on this. Okay, what happened after the days of Yeshua? This is something we've already talked about. Yeah. Excellent. What happened was that they started going downhill and these books had to be written. The Musa, the rebuke, if you want to call it that, began to be written. The lessons had to be learned. The Nevi'im had to share these messages from God because the people really did not uphold the condition. And we've seen this now at the end of the Sefer Yehoshua, how serious it was. There was a covenant which was made that everybody should realize in Eretz Yisrael the recipe for survival is to observe the word of God. And if you don't observe the word of Hashem, then you're in trouble. And they made the commitment. It was a number of times that they actually made these covenants when they crossed the Yarden. We saw that they also did the same thing, and then we saw right at the end of the Sefer, also with the Harivol, Hargrizim, and everything else, they went over this over and over again. The covenant of observing the mitzvot in Eretz Yisrael. So what happened really is that the other books of the Bible are reactionary, and Sefer Yehoshua was meant to be there as a completion. Okay, and I want that to be clear. Sefer Yehoshua, with the whole idea was that the sixth book was meant to show not only the Jews coming to Eretz Yisrael to the edge, as we do by the end of Sefer Devarim, but obviously going in. Being in Eretz Yisrael, arriving, settling, and doing essentially what we were supposed to do, which is to become Am Kadosh, to become a holy nation in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so that's really the plan. And that's the introduction to the Sefer. That's that we saw in the handout that I gave you right at the beginning from Reb Levi. Remember, this is the Sefer that we've been using over and over again, Yitzhak Levi, which I hope now you've sort of come to see why I find that his stuff particularly helpful. And I'm just sorry, as I said, that you know he's been dead 20 years already, and it's really, we're missing something because he had a lot more to give. We also spoke a bit about Sefer Yehoshua in terms of the purpose of what the Sefer is there to teach us, the idea that really not only getting to the Promised Land, but actually being in the Promised Land, as they say, being in Eretz Yisrael was the main purpose, the main thrust of the whole enterprise of what we were trying to achieve. So Yehoshua becomes, as we spoke about here, the idea of continuation. Okay, and this was a very big deal also at the beginning, our discussion between, or about the connection between Moshe and Yehoshua. Moshe really is described, I've got it here, number 12, because it came up again right at the end of the Sefer. Moshe is called the sun, Yehoshua is called the moon. Okay, and the idea is that Moshe being the source of energy, Moshe was the conduit. When Moshe spoke, really he was the mouthpiece through which God spoke to the world, to Am Yisrael, to the Jewish people. And Yehoshua continues that enterprise in Eretz Yisrael. What is the big change from the desert to coming into Eretz Yisrael? What happened? What did they change in terms of their conduct? Because that's really important. Yeah, it's not. And like the Chalutzim, it's very, very interesting how it compares so beautifully to modern Jewish history. One of the things that I've been very restrained, but I've tried to bring in as much as I can, but I tried to get as non-political as I could, because otherwise we get into all these massive discussions which are off the text, but they're important, which is the whole comparison between what happened then and what has happened in our generation. We have a tremendous zechut that we see Eretz Yisrael being rebuilt all over again. And we get some idea of the excitement of what it must have been when the Am Yisrael got there the first time. Okay, they came in and they had this tremendous sense of purpose. They had this tremendous sense of finding their place and becoming attached to the land. And of course, what we've said is that when it comes to Moshe Rabbeinu and Yeshua, this is now what we're discussing, the whole idea of Yeshua continuing that drive, that purpose, but at the same time recognizing that in Eretz Yisrael there are going to be many, many more situations which are going to run according to the natural order, what we call in Hebrew, Lefi Teva, all right, according to nature. But of course, the reality is that we understand from the Battle of Jericho onwards, or even before that, crossing the Yarden, that there's always going to be the help of God, the Siyata Dishmaya, the help of heaven, as and when it is required. Okay, so that is important. Coming into Eretz Yisrael was a transition from a desert situation where everything was based on miracle, the be'er, the well, and the man, and everything else. They brought a bit of the man, remember, into Eretz Yisrael to keep them going for a few weeks. They had it, and it didn't go bad. It stayed okay, till they got to a point when they had to move away from that. They started producing their own crops and their own food. Okay, and of course that runs in terms of battles as well. Battle of Jericho starts off as being essentially miraculous, although it's called a battle, really wasn't. It was a one-sided, just, you know, sort of reminds you of the story, you know, when they blow the house down, they literally walked around and the house came down. But at the same time, later on, we're already talking about real battles, Battle of Ai, and the 31 kings that eventually were conquered. Those were milchamot. Okay, and they may have been miraculous in nature in many ways, but they had to get an army, they had weapons, and they had to go and fight. So that's very important. Again, the transition, this is a word that, you know, if there's any question on these lines in the exam, that's a word that I need to see. Transition. Okay? It's a good word. Transition. We keep doing this in our lives. You've all transitioned from high school to Manhattan. Right? For better or for worse. I wonder how you guys survive. My two daughters came here. One was very ecstatic living in Manhattan. My younger daughter was, for the first month, cried her eyes out. She really did not enjoy being in Manhattan. I'll never forget it. Eventually got used to it but she said, you know, 3 a.m, got these crazy sirens going off around here. You probably don't hear it anymore, and I'm sort of glad that it doesn't affect you, but it's tough. Transitioning is always going to be very, very difficult. All right, now, We had a whole bunch of discussions about the first chapter in terms of continuation or change. All right, I gave you this handout which has a whole bunch of comparisons between Moshe and Yeshua, which show a certain amount of change. Moshe was chosen by God, absolutely without the people being involved, but in the terms of Yeshua, there was certainly an element of the people being involved with Yeshua in terms of recognizing him and supporting him, as we already see from the first chapter. And if you think about it, all the way through the Sefer, he's always looking for the popular support. Okay, he gives his speech right at the end as well, when we saw those two chapters right at the end. He is trying to rally the people, he's trying to get popular support from the people for the way forward, for the ideas that he's putting through. Again, I'm not going to go through all of this, but you've got it in front of you. It's pretty clear. There are many situations of continuation, and there are a number of very important changes that take place between Moshe and Yeshua. Okay, so I think that's something that you should be sort of become aware of and get your heads around. As I said to you, there might be a lot of hints today about what exactly the test is going to be about. Any questions on that? I hope that's clear. Okay, moving on. Number two. Rachav and her life and lessons for posterity. Okay, let's talk a bit about Rachav. Give me some background information. Right, who is this lady, Rachav? Yes, Meredith.
She was a prostitute.
Yeah, well, okay, that's one interpretation. Other people say the word comes from mazon, that she had an inn. She was an innkeeper.
Right.
Okay, my guess is she probably... Technically, she did probably both, right? That's
right.
That's really what we can.
Had a little whatever.
question, what was the side business? And that I don't know, and I'm not going to guess, but, you know, that's the way it is. That was the real one. And remarkably, how many years was she in prostitution, according to Chazal? 40 years. 40 years, it's a lifetime. Just think about this woman, 40 years in that sort of lifestyle, in that sort of atmosphere, and then pulls herself to the point out of it where she's ready to marry. Who does she end up marrying? Yeshua. It's unbelievable. Marries the boss.
Saved the nation of Israel.
And she saved the nation of Israel. Now, it's an interesting thing. Why did they go to her house? That's something that is worth thinking about. Let Meredith continue the story. I know you're jumping out of your seat over there, but
okay.
Let's... Yeah, Kalev and Pinchas, right, according to tradition.
So they went to her because kings used to confide
in them. Yeah, yeah.
Tell their military secrets.
Yeah, as has been the want of these sort of ladies for ever and ever.
Right.
All right, especially the ones that Rachav had a reputation like around the world. It's kind of scary. Chazal, the rabbis, if you want to read about her, they say some pretty, honest, startling things about her. Okay, in terms of her reputation, but she really did know everything that was going on in Eretz Canaan. She had connections everywhere. Okay, so going to her inn or whatever it was, tavern, was certainly a good idea, right? But of course, what happens? What's the basic story?
So they went to her, and then she realized that, like, she had heard of all the miracles that had happened.
Right. Yeah. Excellent. And what sort of language does she tell the spies? Where do we find those amazing words that she utters? You know, she talks about God, God of Israel, right? Which prayer, which tefillah? Yeah, Junior. In Aleinu. It's unbelievable how those words become transported into the Aleinu prayer. All right? So that's really important point to mention. Any discussion about Rachav is how we have taken her words coming from the sort of, you know, person that she represented beforehand, and how she's been elevated, that, you know, for posterity, that means forever and ever. After she died, we more or less quote her three times a day. It's quite amazing. Every Jew in the world, quite something. It's a very special thing. So that's in terms of Rachav, and obviously, what is the sort of major lesson about Rachav? You know, what is she coming to teach us in a sort of more, let's use the word, generic way than specific? What is she doing? Go on, Meredith, you're finishing. You're on a roll here.
So, she teaches us that no matter what level you're at, you can do the highest form of teshuva and become one of the.
Correct. You can turn your life around. You can make yourself, not remake yourself, but you can
change your name.
Change it. Well, in this... what I like about this is that, in fact, she didn't change. She stayed with her name. She didn't become, she really did stay with this. And she's always known as Rachav, and didn't all of a sudden, you know, become, from becoming Morris to becoming Moshe. She didn't do that. You know, she stayed Rachav the whole time. You see what I mean? And that's a very big plus. Which element of tshuva, by the way, did we see specifically in terms of the arrangement? She obviously, we all know the story, that she arranged for her family to be saved, or they made a deal. The spy said to her, if you're all together, there's got to be a siman. What did we say about that sign? Because that's rather significant. Okay, there was a string. And why is that significant? What does that connect to?
Connect to Yom Kippur.
Yom Kippur. Why? Because? Excellent. What would happen to the string that they would see? Turn white. And I so believe that this is symbolic for Rachav, that not only was it something where it's an act of teshuva to use this kind of string hanging out of the window, which is where all the men used to, you know, sort of disappear out of the back window if they had to, climbing down a rope. So she would hang this string as a kind of act of repentance. Now it's not about men visiting her and leaving her, but it's about becoming a person, a more godly person, a much more godly person. But at the same time, it's also a symbol of tshuva. That red string is really, really significant. Okay? In Jewish tradition, it becomes very significant on Yom Kippur. Yeah, Nancy?
What was it doing?
Yeah, it's one of the strange miracles of Yom Kippur is that they would have this red string in two places, in fact. They would have it on the animal that was sent out into the desert. They would tie it around the horns of the animal. Before it went out, if the Jews were forgiven, the string would turn white. Also, I think it was also in the Beit HaMikdash, if I'm not mistaken, the same thing. I'm pretty sure it's in two places, but I'd have to check that. But that's the basic idea. The idea that the string symbolically would show the forgiveness of Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, at that particular moment. And of course, for Rachav, this is a great thing. Okay, she makes the condition, she makes the commitment, and we know by the end she is saved. Excuse me, her family is saved, everyone is saved with her. Okay, so Rachav is really someone to be very aware of, and certainly to have sort of basic information about her. Her descendants became the Nevi'im, etc. She had no, with Yeshua, she had no sons, only had daughters, which is interesting, and there was no obvious successor. That becomes a bit of a problem later on. Although again, if we are talking about continuation of Moshe, Moshe had two sons also that were not following in his footsteps. Okay? Two of them. So the idea was that, as with Moshe, Yeshua did not have an obvious successor to the throne. When he dies, we know that there's a big problem, there's like a vacuum, nobody to take over, and of course it becomes very difficult. The book of Shoftim, right at the beginning, who will lead us? Mi Yaleh. Okay, look at already the first Pasuk, and it talks about the tribes. Yehuda will lead, Yehuda Yaleh. Yehuda has got to lead. In other words, it's not an individual, it becomes a tribe. And then, of course, other tribes just, you know, start arguing, disagreeing. Why should tribe A be stronger or holier than tribe B? And this is where all of the tribalism starts, the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. Pretty amazing. Anything else you want to add with Rachav? I think Rachav, we covered her pretty well, and we've said quite a lot. Very, very impressive individual in so many ways, and so many things to say, so much to include. And again, you've got this major handout. We talked about Rachav, a very special Baalat Tshuva. Okay, and this is something which I'm sure... Oh, the whole... one of the interesting things that we mentioned, of course, is the Midrashic statement of Rachav's willingness to change. Well, you know, the question obviously is, why did everybody else not follow Rachav? Why was she just such an individual in this? And we know that there were three letters, right? That's something that's worth remembering. The story of the three letters that was sent by Yeshua to every single leader, melech, sheikh, whatever you want to call them, in Eretz Canaan, to tell them that we're coming. And you've got your choices. The choice number one is that we make peace, but it will mean that you become subservient. Not that we're going to make you slaves. Slave is the wrong word. You're going to become servants. We're going to give you parnasa. We're going to make sure that you live in Eretz Israel, but you will be under the rule of the Jewish people, who will be in control. Okay. That's deal number one. Deal number two is that if you disagree with that, of course, then we are not going to be able to talk about peace. We're going to have to talk about war. And that's essentially the content of these letters, without getting into too many details. And Rachav seems to have been the only one who took the letters seriously. All the other leaders basically saw it, and whatever they did with it, one assumes they just tore them up. Did not respond. So that's Rachav. Rachav is really very, very amazing woman. Had a credible reputation and is, as I've suggested, one of the great Baalei Tshuva in the Bible. Okay, I always talk about Rachav on the female side, and David HaMelech, surprisingly, on the male side. If you're talking about Baalei Tshuva, David tries after Bathsheba, after that story, to do tshuva for the rest of his life. Successful or not, that's a matter of debate. I'm not quite sure. All right, number three. Forgot no more to say about Rachav. Let's move on. Number three, the spies and a comparison to the sending by Moshe. Now that's an interesting discussion. Anyone want to help me out here? Obvious question, why did Yeshua send spies? If we're talking about a continuation from Moshe, then Moshe's effort to send spies was clearly a failure. So why did Yeshua decide to do this? Yes, Batchen.
So I remember when Yeshua was
excellent. The whole purpose of the spying mission with Moshe was completely different. It was much more to go and see if Eretz Yisrael is a nice place, right? So they went on a pilot trip. They, in fact, that's what Moshe agreed to, but of course what they then went and did, this is according to the Malbim's interpretation, instead of Latur, they became Leragel. That's the key, the two key words. Latur, Tayarim, modern Hebrew. Tourist, Tayar. Okay, that's the word that they were encouraged to go and do, just to go and see it. We've talked about Eretz Yisrael over and over and over again, says Moshe. You want to go and see it? Go and see it. Go and check out the falafel bars, whatever it is. Go and see which is good. Good place to go and eat. But the point is that they turned it around and they became meraglim. And that was not accepted. Meraglim means military spies. Literally regel, to go by foot, to go and check all of the movements of the chel regel. Chel regel in modern Hebrew is the chir. Chir is the infantry, right? The foot soldiers. And that's what they did. They turned the mission into a spying mission of military purpose. And of course, this was doubting the strength of God's promise to come into Eretz Israel. It became a crisis of faith. And as a result, that whole generation was denied access to Eretz Israel. That was not what happened with Yoshua. Yoshua learned the lesson and he specified absolutely 100% to the people going to check out the land, you are going to be meraglim. You are going to spy the land for the purposes of bringing back information that we need. Because in Eretz Yisrael, remember, it's no longer a miraculous existence. We have to plan for war. We have to plan for battles. We want to rely on Hashem, but on the other hand, we've got to be realistic. We have to know what enemy we are facing. So that's why it became meraglim in the time of Yeshua, but it wasn't meraglim, or it shouldn't have been meraglim at the time of Moshe. Okay, I hope that's clear. Does that make sense? Yes, you want to say anything more? That you're good on that?
No, I'm good. I was also going to say that in the time of Moshe, the lack of emunah
and hishtadlut. Yeah, absolutely. And the hishtadlut is very much part of what they needed to do now, which at the time of Moshe was a completely different situation. Excellent. Any comments, any additions to that? I think we're good on this. Yes, please, Sam.
Also, just in terms of that being a general idea, but in terms of the specifics.
Yeah.
Like Yoshua, like, did it quietly and everyone knew about Moshe.
Excellent. If you're going to make any sort of attempt to answer comparison, you've got to really come out with the major differences, right? Also, the number of spies. 12 as opposed to 2. What was the famous thing about Pinchas? I love that little midrashic twist when she was hiding them on the roof. Says that she hid him. Him? Supposed to be them. 2 spies. So what happened? Kalev got hidden under the flax. What happened to Pinchas? He kind of disappeared. He's a very interesting character. Pinchas becomes Elio Hanavi. Elio Hanavi, is he a human being or is he a malach? Alright? As far as we're concerned today, Elio's got the status of malach. Malach HaBrit. Comes to visit every Brit Mila. Right? Busy guy. And if he's not doing that, then he's getting ready for Pesach. He's coming to visit every Seder. Okay? My parents-in-law in London, they 2 o'clock in the morning, they opened the door for Elio Navi, and there was this lady sitting on the doorstep at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was pretty amazing. What she was doing, I think she was homeless. I'm not sure how she actually got to that particular road. It was in the suburbs in London. And what do you do when you open the door at 2 o'clock in the morning and somebody is sitting there? It wasn't dangerous. She was—I don't know what she was doing there. Maybe she was lost. So they tried to sort of direct as much as they could. That was a bit too graphic to be, you know, Leonovi. Open the door, boom, and somebody is there. My favorite thing—if you've seen the movie, which a lot of you may have seen in high school—The Devil's Arithmetic. If you know that story, some of you may know it. It's an Elio Hanavi story. It's a very interesting. It's a movie which is worth, if you can get it on Netflix or something like that, it's worth seeing. Where at that moment of opening the door, the girl who is very secular in the movie, Kirsten, whatever her name is, this actress that you may have heard of, she is transported. In fact, the whole story is she has a dream, but she's transported back to Poland where she sees the life of the person she was named after. She's 21st century with tattoos and the whole works, right? It's a good story. And at that moment of Elio Hanavi, she is transported back to becoming Chanalo or Rochalo, wherever she was when she came from where she came from in Poland, and sees the life and is literally transformed by that experience. All right, she wakes up at the end because eventually she's taken away by the Nazis. She's in a concentration camp, and the whole story is a very intense story, but it's a very powerful story. The metaphor, and it's all revolving around the tradition of Eliyahu HaNavi. So if you haven't seen that movie, it's certainly worth taking an hour and a quarter, and spending time to see it. Devil's Arithmetic, excellent film. All right, now, so that's the spies, comparison to the sending by Moshe. Anything else that you want to add? We will move to the next item. We're good, excellent. Nobody's fallen asleep yet. I'm working on it, but trying to make you sleepy. Number four, the events of the 10th of Nisan. All right, this is kind of a mind blower. Yarden and the Stones. Sounds like a pop group, Yarden and the Stones. All right, let's see, where are we? The memorial stones. Let's talk about those for a second. Let's go back to before that. The Yarden, 10th of Nisan. Okay, the 7th of Nisan was the day when they were told, prepare yourself. In 3 days' time, you're going to cross the Yarden. We made a comparison between crossing the Yarden and a previous event. What event did we compare it to? Where they prepared for 3 days. Har Sinai, the acceptance of Torah. Okay, so that's a useful discussion to have. That when we're talking about this special day, it does have so many parallel elements to the receiving of the Torah on Mount Sinai. Okay, and that's something that we did elaborate a bit more. Please look at what we wrote and what we said. That's the 10th of Nisan, that's the crossing of the Yarden. In fact, we even said that when they were in the middle of the Yarden, there was a covenant that was made, as I just mentioned, with Yeshua made the Jews promise to God to keep the Torah, and the words that are used are very similar to the concept of Naaseh V'Nishma. It's almost as if they're doing Naaseh V'Nishma all over again in the middle of the Yarden. Okay, crossing of the Yarden, remember what happened to the water? It didn't just stop, but what did it do? Yeah, it went. It split, but what did the water go? It went upstream, right? It went to, apparently I understand, it went back to a place called Adam. If you go now to that part of Israel on the River Jordan, there is something called Gesher Adam. Okay, there is actually a bridge over there. At that place, it's still a place that is recognized to this very day. I didn't know that, but somebody pointed that out to me quite recently. Gesher Adam. And of course, it starts building up into some sort of pillar of water, which is seen around the whole country. This whole event of crossing the Yarden was very, very significant, very dramatic. And of course, what was it revolving around? What led the Jews in the Yarden and eventually came out of the Yarden at the end? It was done through which element, through which item specifically? Yeah, the Mishkan, or something more specific than the Mishkan. What is it called? The Aron. Excellent. The Aron HaKodesh. And that's, again, another element that we need to be aware of. The power, the effect of the Aron HaKodesh right through the early stages of Tanakh. Okay? The Aron represented Hashra'at HaShchinah, the presence of God in the Jewish people. It's carried by the Levim, especially by one of the families of the Levim. And this Aron was so, so significant, so special. It was very, very important. It represented, in their circumstance, in their transitional situation of being more controlled by the laws of nature, they had the Aron to represent God's presence within that new framework. All right, and therefore, when the Aron touched the water split. They crossed over the Yarden. There is the suggestion they could have gone further upstream and crossed without having a miracle, but it was necessary to make that particular point. That, you know, there are certain things which they will always have to recognize God's presence amongst them, even in the situations where there was a natural answer to their problem. They could have gone further upstream and crossed on a bridge or whatever, low tide, but they were shown that, you know, that crossing the stream with God's help was really part of what coming into Eretz Yisrael was about. We did speak about that. We spoke about the stones. What did we say about the stones? Yeah, how many sets of stones were actually set up, and what was the purpose of all these stones? Avanim. Okay, the stones, yes.
Was it an or a match?
One suggestion was four, but most rabbis agree it was either two or three. All right, two or three sets of stones. So let's talk about those very briefly. The main place of main idea of putting the stones in the river was, right, that was the first set that we're talking about. Actually, in the river, what did it show? What did it mark? Where they actually went through, where they crossed, right? It was a memorial. They would be sticking out of the river and people would go there and they would be able to say a bracha, she'er asan lanu nisim b'makom hazeh. It's brought in the Gemara about that. That if you see those stones, you say a bracha that God did a miracle for us in this place. Okay? Nowadays we don't see them, but in Talmud it says certain rabbis were actually able to determine where those stones were, which is interesting. That's already sort of, you know, 1500 years after the event, if not longer. The other stones that we're talking about were very specific, and we had a whole discussion about when they were established, that they went all on the 10th of Nisan after they crossed the Yarden. Where did they go from the place that they crossed? They went to a place called Gilgal. And what did they do in Gilgal? They established a Mizbeach, right? An altar. What did they do on the altar? They wrote something very unique. Somebody help me out here. What did they write? The easy answer to this question. Right? The whole Torah. They wrote the Torah. It was one of the mitzvot, which already mentioned in the Chumash, in Sefer Devarim, that when they come into Eretz Yisrael, they should have a place where the Torah is written. It says, Ba'er Heitev, with great explanation, Rashi says, in 70 languages. And that, of course, defies the imagination, because where would they pick up 70 languages? They've been in the desert for 40 years. So you have to talk about an event which is surrounded with miraculous elements. There's no other way to understand it. All right, because how could they write? They didn't have a Berlitz, or they didn't have a, you know, sort of an instant translation that you can have on your, back to the smartphone, you can have that today, but they didn't have all that stuff. So how did they write 17 languages? And of course the question then is, what actually did they write? Was it the whole Torah? Or what was another suggestion that they actually wrote? What's the kind of synopsis? The, not the Shema, but almost right, the, sorry? Aseret HaDibrot, they wrote, is that what you said? I didn't hear what you said. No, the Aseret HaDibrot, they wrote the Ten Commandments, which again, we believe contains the whole essence of the mitzvot of the Torah. So whichever way you look at it, that was all happening on the 10th of Nisan. Alright, the Har Grizim and Har Eval episode, which is at the end of chapter 8, Perichet, that, according to the Malbim, remember we spoke about that, that happened later. That, although some rabbis suggest that was the third set of stones, if that's the way to describe it, that was another element of using stones to make a memorial, but that was later, that was after the Battle of Ai, and that was specifically, again, to carry out that particular commitment, like another covenant. They're always making covenants, all the time. Covenant, a two-way agreement. We'll do for you, and then hopefully God, you'll do for us. Okay? That's the concept the whole way through here. Making and impressing upon them the importance of the mutual agreement. Covenants between God and the Jewish people. Are we going to say any more about the stones? I don't think so. No. Alright. I'm avoiding making the obvious joke here. But anyway, yes.
Could we say that there was also a set that Moshe...
Yeah, and there was a suggestion also that Moshe had done on the other side of the Yarden. But that may not be part of what we're talking about here, but it's also establishing the pattern. That becomes, what these stones really become is like a mezuzah. They're considered like a doorpost to the land of Israel. And of course, our mezuzah has the Shema, which is also essentially one of the statements of faith, and therefore, coming to Eretz Israel, they had to have a mezuzah, which is even more substantial than that, which has on it the whole of Torah. And this was, Yeshua was different. Yeshua did something in Eretz Yisrael, further into the land. All right, not coming into the land, but further away. Different explanations on how exactly what happened. But Moshe was on the other side, was outside Eretz Yisrael. Yeah. This again is what defies the imagination. It was all done on one day. 10th of Nisan. Right, we talk about, and I mentioned this, Shabbat HaGadol in Eretz Mitzrayim, in Egypt, was the 10th of Nisan. Right, that was the day that they took in the animal to the house, the lamb, in order to prepare for the Yetziat Mitzrayim. So the 10th of Nisan in Egypt became a very special day, and the 10th of Nisan crossing into Eretz Israel became equally, if not more, special than the 10th of Nisan in Egypt. All right, for us it becomes Shabbat HaGadol because in Egypt turned out to be Shabbos as well, that date. Okay, this was, did we say what day of the week it was? I don't remember, but I don't think we commented, or we know that obviously it's just before Pesach, but we're not so bound by the day of the week, but we're bound by the date. The 10th of Nisan becomes a very special landmark in Jewish history, both in Egypt and coming into Eretz Yisrael. It's interesting. It's almost like a, you know, bookend. They leave on the 10th of Nisan from Eretz Mitzrayim, and they come into Eretz Yisrael also the 10th of Nisan. Okay? Kind of significant. Same date at both ends of that particular piece of history. All right. Okay, we're wending our way through this. Number 5, Brit Milah, Korban Pesach, linked to Eretz Yisrael, the benching. Okay, what is the link to Brit Milah, Korban Pesach, and Eretz Yisrael? Okay, this is like a sort of massive question which actually has a very simple answer. What exactly do you have to do to prepare for Korban Pesach? What ceremony has to be done to the men? Particularly, they have to have circumcision, Brit Milah. All right. Why was this now necessary? Hadn't it been done all the time they'd been in the desert? So the answer is,
they didn't
because number of reasons, but one of the main reasons. Correct. It was more the climate, more than the water. It was the climate. There was had to be a certain wind blowing, which was very gentle. And it was felt that it was sakana. To do Brit Milah in the desert was really a dangerous thing to do. There was not the right place for recovery. And this became a big problem in the desert to the point where they did Brit Milah once. According to most opinions, they did it when they came out of Mitzrayim. That was the night of Pesach, the Dam Milah, the Dam Pesach. They sprinkled the blood on the doorpost. That's a whole story by itself. And then once at the beginning of the 40 years, and then never again until they came to Eretz Israel. And in order to do the Korban Pesach, which as we explained is in itself an expression of faith in Hashem and sort of celebrating that particular Chag and everything that it represented, the Festival of Freedom, Chag Cheruteinu, the time of freedom, they had to do Brit Milah as a preparation. Why is it so significant, and we spoke about this, to Eretz Israel, the whole concept of Brit Milah? Who is attributed to the first Brit Milah ceremony in the history of the Jewish people? The answer is Avraham Avinu, who is also attributed to being the first Jew to go to from Ur HaKasdim to Eretz Israel. So it all ties up. It's one of those things that in fact we believe is one of the keys to our connection to the land of Israel. We said in the Birkat HaMazon, and please remember this, Birkat HaMazon, Al Eretz Chem Datova, etc. No Delecha, the second paragraph, which we understand was composed by Yeshua. That's the tradition, second paragraph of the Birkat HaMazon. And in that paragraph, he talks about Vial Britecha, Shechatam Tabisra. And after talking about Eretz Israel, Eretz Chem Datova, Chava, how wonderful Eretz Israel is, he then talks about the covenant, the Brit Milah. So the question is, my high, what's one thing got to do with the other? And the answer is everything. Because we believe that by making Brit Milah even outside Eretz Yisrael, and how much more so in Eretz Yisrael, we in fact reconnect with Avraham Avinu, with our commitment, our faith in being in Eretz Yisrael. And as I mentioned to you, I heard Rabbi Franz say this, that one suggestion of why the Arab population in Israel is so attached to the land of Israel, as much as we are in many ways, is because they also have Brit Milah in their tradition from Avraham through the tradition of Ishmael, not through the tradition of Yitzchak. Okay, and it's so interesting that they, in fact, seem to have an unnatural connection. Okay, you would say it's disturbing how connected they are nowadays to the point of conflict and everything that goes on. But they have a zechut. They have the zechut of Brit Milah. It's a very powerful mitzvah, very powerful mitzvah. And when we do it in Eretz Yisrael, by the way, they say an extra bracha, Shechianu. We don't say Shechianu in Chus La'aretz, but in Eretz Yisrael you say Shechianu, which I think gives an extra chashivut, gives an extra importance. Say Shechianu means, you know, something kept us alive for this moment. Kimanu For this time, we've been kept thus alive. Very special. And there was a hand flapping over here. Yes.
Can you explain what's the connection to benching?
To benching, because it's mentioned in the benching. That's part of the second paragraph, which is the paragraph of Eretz Yisrael, Nodeh Lecha, which talks about the land of Israel. And in that paragraph, one of the things that's mentioned is Brit Milah. So, of course, what's the connection that we should mention Brit Milah? We're talking about Eretz Yisrael. Excuse me, and the answer is because that is one of the big connections to Eretz Yisrael. It's really important. It's really special. The Korban Pesach, as I mentioned, and I spoke about this very briefly, is a mitzvah which signifies tremendous spiritual uplift. Okay, it's one of those mitzvot which goes through Jewish history again and again, is mentioned when Am Yisrael are in the process of repair, when they're in the process of aliyah, if you want to call it that. Okay, later on, it's mentioned, for instance, Chizkiyah HaMelech has a very big attempt to bring the Jews back to God after years of idolatry in Malachim Bet. And he talks there, one of the things he did, Korban Pesach. King Yoshiyah, even later, when it's really almost at the end, almost the Korban, but he tries to bring the Jewish people back to God, what does he do? Korban Pesach. In 1967, I mentioned to you, Rabbi Goren, after the Six-Day War, had a disagreement with Moshe Dayan. This is recorded. And the disagreement was about Korban Pesach. Goren was absolutely convinced that this is a messianic moment and we have to come to the Har HaBayit. We can do it and we can bring Korban Pesach. He'd already worked out where we could do it, how we could do it. And Moshe Dayan, the head of the army at the time, was secular. Israeli, not a religious man, he said no. Not for religious reasons, he wasn't being anti-religious. He said that at this point, politically, we just are not able to do this. It wasn't the right time. And one looks back and sort of 45 years later, and I certainly feel it was a missed opportunity. It's a great shame. Could have done it then, and who knows what the world would have been like today. Different world. It's fascinating. So that's Korban Pesach, the link to Eretz Yisrael, and the benching. Any comments before we go on? Yeah.
Just a question. You said it signifies tremendous what?
Change. Tremendous spiritual uplift. Right? At a time when the Jewish people are being inspired. Come closer to Hashem. And whenever it's done, it's like 6 or 7 times in the Bible. It talks about Korban Pesach. It's always at a time of tremendous uplift. Sometimes it works. And unfortunately, the majority of times, it really doesn't. But it's an attempt. Number 6, the Battle of Jericho, and Ai. Okay, Jericho, not really a battle, very much a one-sided event, as we know. Similarities and differences. Obviously, Ai is much more a battle than a miraculous event. But obviously, what is the main difference between Jericho and Ai? That Jericho was literally one-stop shopping, if you want to call it that, whereas Ai was how many stops? How many attempts to do I, right? Always think about your two eyes, right? You'll always remember it. I was a double attempt. It didn't go in one shot. It had to be done twice. The first time, remember the comparison, Yeshua seems to be very, you say in French, laissez-faire, very laid back about the whole thing. Very laid back. Didn't even attempt to go. Sent a couple of guys to check it out. Bring 2,000 or 3,000 people. Everything will be fine. And it was a disaster. How many people were killed in the first battle of Ai? Very famous discussion, we mentioned it. Right? There's a number that is mentioned in the Pasuk. Half the Sanhedrin, or just over half the Sanhedrin equivalent. Right? Remember the number we spoke about? 36. And some say it was, in fact, Ya'ir ben Menashe, he was the equivalent of 36 men of the Sanhedrin. He was such a holy guy. So one person was killed, or 36 men were killed, whichever way it was a disaster, it wasn't meant to happen. So as a result, Yeshua replanted the whole thing with Achan. I remember one of the things that Yeshua did, which created the problem, is that he made a strict law. What did he do? There was a law of spoils, right? Sorry, not Yeshua made it, not just not to take from Jericho, from the actual stones or whatever, but even the spoils of war were not allowed to be taken, which is not the halachas according to the description in the Torah. He made a strict presentation of that particular rule, and as a result, who took it? Remember, Achan. And what did we say about Achan? He described and he becomes one of the examples of the Sefer, one of the guidelines of this whole book. Kol Yisrael, what's the expression? Raven Zebazer. Achan proved that when one person does bad, it affects the whole nation. And this is something which we've lived with, or we've lived by that standard, really forever and ever. What was the comparison to the guy in a boat? Somebody remind me, what was he doing?
Drilling a hole
in a boat, right? Do not try this at home. Sitting in a boat, drilling a hole and saying, well, it's underneath my seat, so no problem. So everyone else sitting in the boat says, well, it is a bit of a problem, because apart from the fact we're on the Titanic, raw equivalent, or not, but more to the point, it's not your seat. The hole will affect everybody. When the Titanic hits the iceberg, unfortunately, everybody goes down with the boat, more or less. Few survivors, but that's the way it is. Yes? Yeah, a guy called Yair ben Menashe. Yair ben Menashe. All right, we're getting very rapidly to the end of this. Other similarities and other differences, please again look at the stories. Obviously, we spoke a bit about the idea of I being much more Derech HaTeva, but they did it in a very clever way. They did two groups. In fact, remember, there was a third group. There were three. There was one group, Yeshua's group, was to make the men of Ai come out again. The other group was waiting behind the city to come in from the back end of the city and set the city on fire. And there was a third group, Marab, a third group, and they were to cut off any help that was going to come from somewhere else, right? From Betel or something like that. And they also would be kind of for the people of Ai, they would see those only few thousand people waiting, and they would say, well, we'll finish off Yeshua, and then we'll go and finish those guys. Not realizing that there were 30,000 people hidden in camouflage waiting to come into the city once Yeshua had drawn all the soldiers of Ai out of the front gates, which is exactly what he managed to do. The whole battle plan was brilliant. And of course, as a result of that, it becomes much, much different to the first battle. The second battle is a tremendous chiddush, tremendous chizuk, and everything that goes with it. Number seven, the Givonim, very briefly. Tell me about the Givonim, who they were, where they came from. They made out as if. What was the as if and what was the reality? Okay, somebody help me out here. Excellent. And they wanted to become part of Am Yisrael, not part of the people living in Eretz Israel, but coming from Africa, Ethiopia, wherever. And of course, the reality was, where did they really come from? Yeah, Canaan. They came from up the road. They literally, if you look at Givon today to Yerushalayim, it's very close. Certainly not far away from Yericho and all these other places. So what happened? Well, Yeshua was convinced by them. What did he eventually do? And what is the problem with that? He made a vow, he made a pact, right? He agreed. And of course, everybody turns around to him afterwards and says, but Yeshua, this was done under false pretenses. So what's Yeshua's answer? Can we break our promise? The answer is,
no.
Because, Dina, you got to finish.
Scrutiny from the non-Jews.
Yeah, it will create, and what's the expression that we always use when we get scrutiny like that? Chil Hashem, excellent. It creates Chil Hashem. Okay, and that is what the Gemara says, and that's what Yeshua's line is going to be. He does, however, make very strict conditions for them, but they do realize that by doing what they did, they literally saved their bacon, if that's the word to use. Probably not a good word to use in Stone College. They saved their skin. And again, the whole story is an interesting story. It does have a part two much later on in Jewish history with David HaMelech, which is actually, I've just been studying in the other class I have, where at the end of Shmuel Bet, the Givonim have a demand of David, right? And they have a revenge. They want to take revenge on the house of Shaul, because Shaul, at one point, killed seven members of the Givonim. It was a whole story which happened with Shaul, and David has no choice but to give in to their demand. They said they don't want money, they don't want to be bought off, they want to have revenge, their pound of flesh. They don't seem to be very nice people, let's put it that way. And it's a very strange story. At the end of Shmuel Bet, chapter 21, you can see the kind of continuation of the Givonim story. They always mention the Gemara. Givonim are one of the groups that the Gemara has always got a big question mark. Were, you know, can we count them as Jews? The majority of opinion seems to be that they were converts, but they were always called Geirei, not Geirei Tzedek, they were called Geirei Toshav. Geirei Toshav means that they were converts to be able to live in Eretz Israel, accept the seven laws of Noach, right, to be monotheists, to believe in one God, etc., but not converts in the full sense of you know, card-carrying members of the Jewish people. That they were not. So the Givonim is a whole interesting parasha, which is certainly worth looking at. Number 8, the miracles of Givon and Ayalon, the song and the prayer of Yeshua. That's very, very self-explanatory, that particular event, how exactly that miracle, what it represents, the whole story. Yeshua calling out to God, Shemesh beGivon Dom, it's almost presented as a prayer, presented as a praise of Hashem. All right, what is the big discussion about that actual process? Why was the day extended? Why was the sun ordered to stand still? Because it was what day of the week? You remember the whole discussion that we had, right? Well, it was Erev Shabbos, right? It was Friday, and Yeshua wanted to make sure that the war would be finished before Shabbat. So, according to some, it actually extended not just a few hours; it extended. The sun stood still twice, remember, the middle of the day, and then before Shkia, before the sun went down, it sort of stopped again, and it stayed suspended for anything up to 24 to 48 hours, depending on which opinion you follow. And this is one of the great stories in the Bible, the Barad. Where did the Barad come from? The hailstones from Mitzrayim, according to Midrash. The Midrash, those guys who wrote Midrash were unbelievable, all right? They certainly had vivid imaginations and traditions. Delaying the end of the war of conquest. What did we say about that? What did Yeshua do? Yeah?
There were two reasons.
Yeah.
One, he wanted Jacob to die. He said that if the war will end, he's
going to
die.
Like Moshe Rabbeinu, same thing, right? That's a continuation. Excellent, excellent. And therefore, that was his plus side. That was the plus side. But the problem is that it wasn't accepted as being a positive thing to do because that was his cheshbon. It wasn't seemingly God's plan. And Yeshua did what he did. He did continue the war much longer than it needed. And we are told that as a consequence, how many years of his life were knocked off? Ten years. He lived to 110 instead of his Rebbe, like his Rebbe, living to 120. Okay, which again is kind of significant because he meant, you know, his meaning, his intention. This is with Yeshua a number of times. He has such great kavana, kavanat tova. He wants it to turn out well, but sometimes he just oversteps the mark. And we see that with Yeshua. Maybe that's why he's not classified as one of the really great men in history, though really should be. After learning Sefer Yeshua, you do get a new appreciation of who he is. There is a group that goes every year to the Kever. We know where Yeshua is buried, and they make I saw it in one of the web pages. I've actually got a copy of what they did a few years ago. And they go and daven there. Every time it's his yahrzeit, the day when he died, there is a crowd of people that go and daven at the Kever of Yeshua. So it is recognized to this day. Very quickly, the 2.5 tribes, anything to say about that? What was the danger and what was the result? Right, remember we spoke about that. They were leaving to go back to the other side of the Yarden. What was their parting gift to the Jewish people? Yeah,
Margot. Is it a statue? Or?
It's more than a statue. It was Mizbeach. It was actually an altar. All right. And why did Am Yisrael get very upset? Because it symbolized possibly what were they going to do with that altar? What did they seem to suggest that we could do it, use it for? Korbanot, but not Korbanot to God, but to idolatry, to start using for idolatry. And the whole nation got pretty upset about it. They sent Pinchas, he went to talk to them. They were going to make a war, and they sorted it out. They said that this is in fact our gift to the nation, not something negative, something positive, and it was all smoothed out. So there's no question that Yeshua wanted, again, to continue the promise of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe had said to the 2.5 tribes, come and fight, then you can go home. Yeshua honored that, but at the same time, he was already seeing the signs of possible, friction between the different tribes in Am Yisrael. Yes, question.
Didn't they also get upset about the Mizbeach because they had only put their name on it?
And it may also have been sort of too private, too much what they were. It's similar idea again. Also in terms of the relationship between the tribes staying in Israel and the ones staying outside Israel, there's a lot of friction there. And I think you're right. The interesting thing is that it's only half of Manasseh. The idea of two halves coming together to make a whole. So the two halves of the tribe, one half outside Israel, one half inside Israel, was hopefully going to bind those two groups together. That was the plan. I think we mentioned that, why it in fact became two halves as opposed to a whole tribe of Manasseh living outside. Half would be in, half would be out. So they would always be connected. Number 11, we're almost there. The final farewell. We said that how many times did he address the Jewish people before he died? Right? Twice. The first time, what was the problem? He gave it to the leaders, but?
God didn't answer.
Didn't answer. No reaction. Silent. Right? Absolute science. So what did he do?
Gathered everyone.
Everyone. Part two. Okay, he's good at doing things in two parts, right? And the speeches. So what did he do? He got everybody together, part two, and he made a tremendous speech of not only history, things that we actually read in the Haggadah, that we came from across the Euphrates, and we came into Eretz Israel, and our whole history, but also he said to them, again, that you should know that idolatry, and we spoke a bit about idolatry, what the danger of being idolatrous was, why it was so attractive, because it was a kind of security, all right, for the people that they would have crops, something to eat, even if God was not on their side. Maybe Asherah or Baal or any of these other idols might do it for them. They got very kind of, the danger would be that they would see that as an option. And as a result, the whole problem of becoming idolatrous was very, very serious. And we know by the time we get to about chapter 3 of Shoftim, it really was a practical problem. So that's all of Yoshua's final words. How do you assess his level of leadership? I'm not going to answer that question. It's something for you to think about. All right? What sort of a leader was he? Was he effective? Did he admit his errors? David HaMelech, one of the great things about David in comparison to Shaul is that when Shaul is told you're wrong, he's always making excuses till he finally admits that he's wrong. David immediately, as soon as he's told, like at the end of Shmuel Bet, when he's counting the nation, he shouldn't have counted them, he's told you did something wrong. God the prophet comes and tells him, and you know what? Immediately, Chatati, what do I do to put it right? David is absolutely 100% aware of his limitations. Whereas with Yoshua, maybe you need to make up your mind. I'm not sure. I'm not saying he's a bad guy, I'm not saying anything negative, but in terms of his leadership, his style of leadership, everything that revolves around Yoshua. We're almost finished. Actually, we should have finished 2 minutes ago. Moshe, the sun, Yoshua, the moon, obviously in terms of their relationship, continuation, change, we spoke about that before. Any final questions? Wow, you look pretty shell-shocked. Let me say to you one thing, which, as I always feel, because it's so great, I teach these Sfarim on kind of a cycle, but I always, always get something new out of learning it through yet again. I hope you guys, you know, if you learned Yeshua once upon a time, you've got something from our sessions that we've had. Since, you know, now we're on to sort of over three months together. Just to thank you all, because Mikom Alamdai Skalti, you know, I get so much more. You don't realize maybe, but I learn so much more from you guys in terms of preparation, in terms of your questions, your essays, which really were wonderful. And Bezrat Hashem, I'm sure you'll all do well on the test. If I see you next semester, I look forward. If I don't see you, then let's meet in the elevator at least. Let's say hello. Keep in touch, and really wish everybody well. Have a great vacation when it comes. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Thank you.